Lembit Opik on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good morning, Planet Earth. Lembit Opik here again for 4 hours of news and comment this Sunday morning, stroke afternoon if you're in the United Kingdom, or overnight if you are in Australia. Wherever you are in the world, welcome to the show. Packed program tonight, or this morning, if you're here in the UK, where we wake up to a new political landscape. It hasn't changed much, but the signs are there to suggest a fairly big change. Later on this year when there's a general election. I'm going to be speaking to very informed individuals about objectively what this means for Britain and whether we can really expect a significant change of direction, even if we have a change of government. Shortly, I'm very honoured to have Lloyd Moylan on. He is a Conservative member of the House of Lords, and he's an expert on the built environment, as well as obviously being very well versed in the way that politics works in the UK. So we'll be having, I hope, a rational conversation about what we've seen over the last few days in British politics, what lessons that might have for the UK and indeed for the world. And also, if we have time, to talk about what the built environment is and his views on that too, together maybe with some discussion about transport. We've also got Bishop Kai Dua, Britain's favourite ref, as I like to call him, who will be giving his review about the big stories from the week. Then we have James Roguski, who is very opposed to the World Health Organization. Why? What does it do by way of threat to us? And most importantly, what does he want to see replacing it? And then we have Keith Prince, a successful Conservative politician. He was re-elected to the Greater London Assembly yesterday. How does he view his party? He'll be bringing up the end of the show today. We'll be guaranteed honesty from him, indeed from all of my guests. If you'd like to get involved, then go to tntradio.live and you're welcome to have your say in the chat. As always, when I've got time, I'll read out your comments, whether they're critical, positive, questioning, or informative. You'll also find the phone numbers there. Wherever you are in the world, you'll be able to get in touch with me just by picking up the phone. And if I've got time, I'll put you on to the air as well so that the world can hear your views. All of that with me, Lembit Opik, here at the Home of Free Speech. Before we do go to Lord Moylan, I just want to highlight one story which, frankly, has been irritating me all morning. The state-sponsored British television station has been spending airtime talking about a vegan croissant in France. Now, the story is, you've guessed it, tied into climate change. Oh, yes. Apparently, this croissant is going to save the world by doing away with butter, which is, of course, a milk and therefore animal-based product. They're literally covering this in their bulletins again and again and again. Why? Because, as we know, this state-sponsored channel is obsessed with the idea that the human race is ruining the climate. Whether you believe that or not, let me be honest, I don't think a croissant which is made to vegan specifications is going to save us. What they have neglected to talk about, though it was mentioned lightly earlier on, is the cost. I have no doubt this will be a phenomenally expensive croissant. Why do I mention it? Because this is about the trivialization of news, I think. Rather than talking about that, we might want to talk about more important things like war, famine, the true situation when it comes to international relations. But maybe they think the British population can't cope with those heavy ideas, and therefore we have talk about vegan croissants. I'll make a second prediction. It's not going to catch on. I would suspect that most people who go to Paris have flown there, and they're unlikely to be concerned about having a vegan croissant in preference to a milk-based one. I could be wrong. You put me right in the tntradio.live chat if I've completely misunderstood the situation. But as far as I can see, the climate emergency brigade are getting ever more desperate to keep this story in the media. And that's why we get these desperately trivial conversations about, frankly, irrelevancies, which might be good if you can virtue signal your way to a peaceful state of mind, but probably won't save the planet. Anyway, have your say on that if you'd like to. Great guests coming up, starting with Lord Moylan in just a moment. And, of course, yourselves. This is nothing without your input and your viewership. So thank you, wherever you are in the world, for watching the Lembit Opik Show right here on today's News Talk. And in a minute, we're going to start with Lord Moylan right here on TNT.
Going 360 on the headlines.
It's really well-balanced conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
From the triviality of vegan croissants, we go to the heavyweight, Lord Moylan. Good morning, sir. Thanks very much for joining us on TNT.
Good morning, Lambert.
I'm not going to waste your time with trivia, and I apologize for wasting 3 minutes of your time talking about croissants at all. Let's talk about the serious issues. The elections on Thursday, in my view, were not surprising in terms of their outcome. But before we talk about that, let's hear a little bit about yourself. How does one get to be a member of the House of Lords in the British political system?
I'm not entirely sure, actually. I think it's a matter of being in the right place at the right time as anything else. I mean, I spent, I had a career in local government. I was a local government councillor and deputy leader of a council in London for a long time. I was councillor for 28 years. I was deputy leader for 11 of those years. And then I went, when Boris Johnson was mayor of London, I spent the best part of his 8 years in office working for him, mainly as deputy chairman of Transport for London, which was, he was the chairman, sort of ex officio, but I was his deputy and helped run the transport system in London for him. And then when he became prime minister, he thought I'd be a suitable person to have in the House of Lords, and so he nominated me. And the Queen was graciously pleased to agree.
Yes, I feel that given my rather rocky relationship with the leadership of my former party, the Liberal Democrats, I'm never going to be joining you on those benches. Maybe I should cross party.
Leaders always change. Leaders can change.
Then I shall patiently wait until I get the call.
At some stage, it'll happen, Lembit. Maybe not in your lifetime, but at some stage, you will get the call.
It's cold comfort when you put it like that, to be honest with you. Do you enjoy being in the House of Lords?
I enjoy it enormously. It's not for everybody, I have to say. It's the House of Lords works very hard. It's a part-time house. People say it's got a lot of members, but actually a lot of those members are working part-time. And so if you look at it in terms of full-time equivalents, if you see what I mean, if you think in HR terms, in terms of full-time equivalents, it's probably about 300 or 400 people, which I don't think is too large. A lot of the time is spent on detailed scrutiny of legislation, and backbench peers like me, ordinary peers, backbench peers like me, get very little support in doing that. We don't have, the MPs all get staff and things. We don't get any staff. We get a laptop and we get an iPad, and that's about it. And we are given, if we're lucky, we get a desk in a shared office. I share an office with four other peers. I mean, it's quite comfortable. It's not, it's all compliant with health and safety and get a desk and so on. But you don't get any staff. So when it comes to doing detailed scrutiny of legislation, you really have to do most of it yourself. So you have to sit there. I've got the renters reform bill here sitting on my carpet. It's about an inch and a half thick. And reading that in the course of Sunday afternoon is part of my task for this weekend, and trying to find out what it says, because nobody's going to read it for me.
I have to admit, it's just a coincidence, but I'm actually professionally involved in that bill as well.
Are you?
Only because, it's actually to exclude a group. I don't want to distract my viewers too much on this, but there's an interesting confusion. The relocation sector sometimes gets mixed up with the renters, with the rental section. I won't waste your time on it now, but it's a note to self. I need to send you a proper note about it.
Send me an email. I'll draft an amendment. Or if you've got an amendment, one of the great privileges in the House of Lords is that any of us can table an amendment to a bill, and all the amendments are debated. So if you want to raise a topic, you can do it, and nobody can stop you. And then ministers have to answer. And it's a huge privilege, but it does mean the government comes under very much more scrutiny in the Lords than they do in the Commons nowadays, because the Commons doesn't spend a great deal of time scrutinising legislation compared to
as a member of Parliament.
You used to know that. I mean,
yeah, I, as a member of parliament for 13 years, I totally agree with you. Two things which seem to differentiate the Lords from the Commons are, number one, the quality of debate is higher in the Lords, I think. And number two, it's less partisan. And therefore, it's not all about trying to gain advantage from over your opponents. It's about getting the best outcome. I think for those, I was one of the very few Liberal Democrats, which was my old party, to vote against changing the House of Lords or abolishing it, because I thought if it becomes just a reflection of the elected House of Commons, it's going to get worse. I was disciplined for that, incidentally, for voting against the change.
The only discipline the whips have in the House of Lords, I have to say, it's very hard for the whips, is the only discipline they've got is that if you have a desk, they can take it away. And that is the ultimate sanction. In fact, it's the only sanction they've got, because they can't say you're not going to have a career in politics, because most people in the House of Lords don't think they have a career left in politics. They just do the job. Or you're not going to be a minister. Most people don't want to be a minister. All they can say is, well, right, you're taking your desk away. And you have to wander the corridors looking for somewhere to work. That's the only sanction they've got. So I don't know what discipline you were subject to. I think you're right, though, in asking about reform of the House of Lords. I mean, obviously, there is always going to be a case in a democracy for saying that you should have all parts of your legislature should be elected. Of course, I understand that. But I'd look at it the other way around. I'd start by saying, you know, you need to understand, first of all, what's the House of Lords do? And most people don't really understand what the House of Lords does. You do. But most people don't understand that role of scrutinizing legislation in detail and the work of the select committees, which we might come and talk about later, as you mentioned, built environment. They don't understand what we do. The second question is what we do valuable and necessary? And if it is, how will you make sure it continues to be done in any reformed House of Lords, in any reformed upper chamber? And if it's an elected upper chamber, of course, obviously you've got a lot of people who'll be thinking about re-election and looking after constituents and things like that, which will take up a lot of their time, and there'll be less attention given to what the House of Lords does very well. And then finally, the question I always ask is, what about the cost? I mean, I've just described to you the grim Dickensian circumstances in which members of the House of Lords are expected to work. Now, elected politicians aren't going to put up with that. They're going to demand at least three or four staff, like the MPs. There's nowhere to put them. There's no office for them. There's nowhere for them to go. The cost will be enormous, and they'll have to build something, some huge building somewhere to put everybody, and there's no space. There's no place to build such a building. So, you know, I think you've got to really think through the purpose of the House of Lords, how you can replicate and sustain that, what the cost is going to be. And then you have this constitutional issue, which of the two chambers prevails in the event of disagreement. At the moment, it's very clear the House of Lords can hold things up, but in the end, if the Commons insists on something, the Commons will get its way because it is elected, and the House of Lords will give way. It knows it hasn't got the electoral standing to withstand what the House of Commons wants. That wouldn't necessarily be the case if you had two elected chambers. I mean, it can be made to work, because obviously large numbers of countries do make it work, but it would be something that would change the dynamic in the Commons considerably.
Those you've actually touched on one of the two key reasons why I opposed a change, and that was because it seems obvious to me that if we have an elected upper house, it will become like a Senate in America. It will become the senior house. If there are fewer people, therefore representing more individuals, more voters each, then they will become senior, even if it takes decades to happen. And the second reason is because I'm really not a great fan of party politics, even though I was leader of the Welsh Liberal Democrats at one point, because the parties themselves seem to, in my view, obscure the outcome at times. It almost as if the opposition party wants the country to fail so that they can get into being in charge. And I see a much more collegiate attitude in the Lords. Is that me just being wistful, or does it feel that way when you're there?
I think what's interesting about the Lords, I mean, that's one way of putting it, but I think I'd put it slightly differently. No party has a majority in the House of Lords, and a good chunk of the House of Lords are crossbenchers, independent peers who don't belong to any party. Although, as far as I can tell, they're pretty left-wing as a group, but they are independent, and they don't have a whip telling them how to vote on particular issues. And the result of that is that if you want to make progress, you need to work with other people across parties. If it's just you and the and a few conservative friends, the government won't take any notice. The government only starts to worry about what you're saying if you're getting support from other parties. So you need to work collegiately in that sense. But it's a transactional thing. I mean, you can be agreeing with somebody from the Labour Party on a particular issue and violently disagreeing with them on something else, from 1 week to the next. These are not permanent alliances. They're quite transactional in that sense. But to make any impression, you do need to work cross-party.
That's something which, the truth is, happens in the law and House of Commons too, but they don't like to admit it because it confuses the public. Yes. After the break, I want to talk with you about your perspective on the outcome of the set of elections, which could be regarded as a bellwether for what's going to happen in the United Kingdom. If you've got a view about what you're hearing from Lord Moylan and myself, do go to tntradio.live. You can get involved in the chat. If I've got time, I'll read out your comments. And also you can phone in as well. All of that with me, Len Bitopic, here on today's News Talk. See you in a minute.
TNT's Jason Allbourne.
One must be optimistic when you see the Prime Minister of Australia telling us that a video showing that a bishop being stabbed is misinformation, and that the E-Safety Commissioner, who used to work for Twitter, now going after the new named X and was a former, well, on the board of the World Economic Forum, say no more. That's the world that we live in at the moment, but everyone can see it. You can't be more exposed. The Emperor, well, the E-Safety Commissioner has no clothes, if you will. It's all coming to the fore, and we will continue to work on this with many, many different ways and processes as we give you the news of the day.
Weekends with Jason Allbourne on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
The human mind is like a computer. No matter how efficient it may be, its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it.
That's a campaign promise.
Tell us the truth. Tell us the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
You're hearing it.
TNT.
Welcome back to the Len Bitopic Show. It's a pleasure to introduce Lord Moylan to the show, Conservative member of the House of Lords. In a moment, we're going to talk about the elections which have just taken place. First, let me read some of the comments coming in. Some of these relating to the vegan croissant, which I'm so cynical about, but I'll read them in order. Lord Melby says there'll be no change in the way the country is run, even after a general election. Hemingway, in relation to the vegan croissant, says, Forest Green, the world's only vegan football club, were relegated into the non-league recently. Their most popular match day snack is a shiitake mushroom burger. Very appropriate. Thanks very much for that. Certain cynicism about vegan croissants here. Red says £300 a day just to turn up in the House of Lords with all expenses. What's not to like, Red? Don't be so cynical. I'd take it if I could get in there. Hermetica says, what might save the planet instead of vegan croissants is if we all switch the state-sponsored station off permanently in the UK. Well, we've got TNT as an alternative. Who needs the state-sponsored television anymore? Red says, abolish the unelected house and the monarchy whilst we're at it. I see a certain theme there, Red. Hemingway says, the only house I've ever bothered was Hector's house, which was a cartoon in my childhood, incidentally. Madrid says, I've just had scrambled eggs from a local farm on locally baked sourdough bread with lots and lots of Celtic salt and butter, apparently. Okay, well, there we are. I think there's a general mood that the vegan croissant is not going to save the day. Red does ask a question, Lord Moylan. How many members of the House of Lords are there? Is it over 800?
It's just under 800. I think it's 790.
Okay, there's your answer, Red. Let's talk about, there's so many more great comments here. Please, I can't read them all out. So if you do want to read them, go to tntradio.live and you can read them and you can get involved as well. Lord Moylan, we've got to talk about the elections. Now, on Thursday, there were a set of elections. There were local elections for local authorities, police and crime commissioner elections, which I've always been very dubious about, and some mayoral elections, which I'm only slightly less dubious about. It's quite obvious Labour made gains. Not as substantial as I'd have expected, to be honest. Conservatives made predictable losses, losing about half of what they, half the local authority positions and just about almost all of the mayoral elections. In your judgment, what are the key learnings from this? Is anything surprising about the outcome as far as you're concerned?
I don't think so, actually. I don't think we know a great deal more than we did before. The results were... what the Conservatives were hoping for was a few bright spots in what they knew was going to be a dark landscape, two in particular. And they got one of those and not the other. In that dark landscape, there were some really quite troubling things, like there was one parliamentary by-election where the swing from Conservative to Labour was over 26%. Now, a swing like that in other parts of the country, in other seats, would reduce the Conservative Party to being a small rump in the House of Commons. So if you focus on that, then it's all terribly troubling. On the other hand, there is some sort of algorithm that produces a thing, I don't understand how this is calculated, called the national equivalent vote. And that's an attempt to say, well, what would the vote be across? Not the whole country was voting yesterday. I just want you to know that. Not everywhere had elections. If you had these figures spread across the whole country, what would they say about the share of the vote for the parties? And that put Labour just 9 points ahead of the Conservatives, which is actually quite a good outcome, given the opinion polls recently. Nobody seriously thinks the Conservatives are going to win the next general election. So what the internal talks are about, the internal anxieties are about, is how badly are we going to lose? Could it be really bad or just ordinarily bad? And that's really what people are looking at these numbers to try and work out. Nobody is looking at these numbers and thinking now that there is a path to victory at the next election.
I've got Keith Prince, who is, in my view, a greatly respected member, a conservative member of the
Great
Society.
Very, well.
Very impressive fellow, and he won a constituency with a substantial majority, I have to say, which does show it's possible to win as a conservative at the time. He'll be on later, and I'm sure he'll give his candid views of London, so I won't spend time discussing that with you. It does seem that... in my opinion, which sounds like the same as yours, the Labour lead is rather overstated. Keir Starmer, who I consistently regard as an underperformer, I think I don't have a high regard for his leadership skills. In some ways, the inevitable comparison is with Tony Blair at the same stage, and he is no Tony Blair. That's often even said on television. Is it possible that Keir Starmer's poor performance, I don't want to put words in your mouth, maybe you have a different view of him, but in my view, his poor performance means that that leader will be eroded as people become more conscious of what it means to have Keir Starmer prime minister.
Well, that's one of the hopes of the Conservatives. I mean, their best hope is if you press them, the leadership will say, well, a lot of people haven't made their minds up yet. And those people might come over to us and not go to Keir Starmer because he's a dull old thing and so on, and boring and doesn't come across as particularly authentic and sincere. And it's possible that that will happen. Who can tell what people who don't know what they're going to do are going to do? They don't know, so how can I know? That's what they hope. I think the Labour has a structural problem. However, and I think that the elections showed it. This isn't to say they're not going to win. But it's a question of how they're going to govern and how long they can govern for, because people are saying, oh, if they have a huge victory, they'll be in power for the next generation. But people said that only 5 years ago in 2019, when Boris produced a huge victory, and they said Labour was out of power for a generation, and here they are poised to take power again. So things are much more volatile. And one of the things that we can see yesterday is that the Greens did very well in left-leaning places. The city of Bristol is a sort of, you know, almost communist sort of city now, really, as far as I can tell. And the Greens did very well in Bristol. And so, because Starmer has shifted the party very markedly and very clearly to the right, people, I mean, you can take the journalist Owen Jones as an example. He's left the Labour Party after years. People who are on the left are thinking about whether they should vote Labour, and the Greens do offer them a sort of radical left alternative. The Greens are not just about vegan croissant and trying to stop us all from eating meat, which is what they want to do. I mean, that's their policy. They want to, you know, this is a conspiracy to stop us all eating meat. They have other things that they have to offer as well to the left. And so they offer an alternative. The other thing that happened yesterday is that Labour has taken the Muslim vote in the UK for granted for a very long time indeed. And they have started to lose the Muslim vote. We saw that with George Galloway in a by-election a couple of months ago. And we saw it again in the council elections in certain northern seats where there's a large Muslim population yesterday. And that's primarily to do with Gaza and the Labour Party's general support for the government's line, which is one of qualified support for Israel, but definitely support for Israel. And it's thought that they're not sympathetic enough to the plight of the people living in Gaza. I mean, I'm not arguing a view on that. I'm just saying that's how they're seen. And so what's happening is that Starmer is narrowing the base on which the Labour Party is sitting. He will win the election, not because of that base, which is now quite narrow, but because large numbers of people who would vote Conservative if Boris was in power, for example, are either going to stay at home, or depending where they live, they might vote Labour, or they might even vote for your old party, the Liberal Democrats, or they'll just stay at home. And that's why he's going to have such a very large victory. But then I think he'll discover when he's in power that it gets harder and harder when you're based on such a narrow, metropolitan, high-minded, globalist base. And I don't know that he'll know which way to turn.
A couple of thoughts there. In my view, the Greens did well, and I don't know why the mainstream media don't see this. The Greens did well, not because of their balmy environmental policies, but because they supported a ceasefire in Gaza, and they played that hard. In my view, incomprehensibly, even leaving aside the morality of it, incomprehensibly, Keir Starmer simply fell in behind the Conservatives. If he'd actually said, I support a ceasefire, regardless of the rights and wrongs of it, he would have actually been in a very strong position. And I lived through the early 2000s when the late Charles Kennedy was leader of the Liberal Democrats, and he took a very firm line against the war in Iraq. And that led to the most successful period in the history of the Liberal Democrats' position. But Starmer seemed too weak to do that. The second thing that I see is in line with what you're saying, that the Conservatives and Labour really don't have much to separate them on the key issues. They've both essentially junked the environmental agenda, though they haven't said so. They're very similar on international foreign policy. And I wonder if you feel as I do that when Starmer gets in, there'll be a massive sense of disappointment with Labour because nothing's going to change.
Well, this is the question about Starmer, isn't it? I mean, nobody really knows him. If he does what you say and carries on basically not changing anything, then I think the scenario I describe, where he finds his base is narrower and narrower, and it's harder for him to carry on in power, will come about quite quickly. But maybe he has a secret plan. Maybe he is going to do things that the Conservatives should have been doing. And that, I think, could, you know, change the country, change the picture completely. Now, all we do know is that the people pulling his strings appear to be, believe it or not, Peter Mandelson and Tony Blair from the 1990s. So at the moment, the suspicion is that nothing's going to change except that we're going to go back 20 years and have the same Blairite agenda that we had starting in 1997. Well, I think if he does that, he's doomed quite quickly as well. I don't think he'll last very long. And I think the party will start to break up under him.
It would require, I'm sure that there's a strain in the party where there's a dissatisfaction with his right-leaning moderation. He could fairly easily run the Conservative Party based on the things he says, actually. I wonder if his problem is he hasn't got a secret plan.
There might be a vacancy after the election. He might switch.
I'm sure there will be a vacancy. It's inconceivable to me that
he could do both jobs in tandem.
Well, you might as well do well, and then we can actually get a proper new party which sorts everything out. I think Reform see themselves in that role as spoilers in the next general election by maybe procuring between 10% and 18% from the Conservative side primarily, and then suing for peace afterwards.
In that parliamentary by-election, Reform came within 100 votes, I think, roughly,
yes,
of the Conservative candidate. Labour won by a large. It was a Conservative-held seat. The Member of Parliament had to resign in disgrace over some sort of corruption type thing, you know, sort of being caught. I don't think any money changed hands, but being caught more or less, as far as I can make out, being open to the idea that he might lobby for a particular industry, gambling, I think. I don't know. I can't remember now. he had to resign. So it was likely we were going to lose the seat. It was a red wall seat, as we call it, essentially working class, patriotic, pro-Brexit type seat. And Reform came in just behind the third, just behind the Conservatives.
And that it was interesting because the Reform vote would have been far higher if Reform had been able to organise candidates across the country. It was suppressed because they didn't have candidates everywhere. One interesting statistic was in those places where Reform did stand, they were getting something like 16 or 17%. Going back to what you said earlier, Lord Moylan, it seems to me that Conservative voters also know the game's up. There's a bit of a circularity in the logic there, but they know the game's up. So they can punish the Conservatives this time by voting any way they please. And Reform might be the acceptable place to go. And then they'll wait and see what the Conservatives do to sort themselves out in opposition. I don't think
it's very sadly, I have come across Conservatives who think exactly like that. Yes.
Yeah. Well, the Conservative MPs I know think like that. I was talking to one who I won't name. He has some. I said to him, "You'll be okay. You have a majority of 12,000." He says that's considered a marginal now.
And if you look, marginal seat. Pardon?
Which basically means that the Conservatives could be into double figures. They could be my guess is between 99 and 165. I've spent quite a lot of time working that out. But increasingly, I think that's the spread. And I think the Starmer will start messing up. So it'll be more towards 165, but both figures are very poor. The question then from the election is, all of the Conservative spokespeople on the mainstream media keep saying, we're going to carry on, we're not going to change our leader, lessons must be learned. But I'm not sure what the lessons will be. It sounds to me that a bit like the Titanic, they can see the iceberg, but they're not going to change course.
Well, the difficulty is that the Conservatives can see, you see the lessons you want to see. Yeah. So there are some people who say the lesson is that we must be more managerial, more centrist, and that will, you know, how we're going to win. And the other lesson is, no, the country has changed. What voters are interested in has changed. And we need to appeal to the people who voted for us last time, who voted for Brexit, who voted for Boris, and so on. And we need to get those people together because that is where the country is. And we need to represent the country. There's no point representing voters who don't exist anymore. So those are the lessons they want to learn. And they will find rich evidence in both yesterday's results and the results of the general election to justify their pre-existing view.
What's a confirmation bias, it's called, when you come to an opinion and then you seek evidence to prove your opinion rather than the other way around.
It's also called politics. That's what politics do mostly. Evidence-based politicians are people who do exactly what you say. they start with a view and then find the evidence for it. That's what politics is. They don't start with no view at all. Why would they be in politics if they had no view at all? Proceed on the basis of some disinterested assessment of evidence.
Although I don't want to drag you into it because I'm not sure where you stand on it. My feeling is the entire climate emergency is a self-affirming scam where everything, heat, cold, drought and flood, are all attributed to the same phenomenon, which is scientifically illiterate. But I won't go down that path now. You may have a different view. A few comments coming in here. Red says it's a uni party. I do tend to think that Conservative, Labour and Liberal Democrats are very similar on some of the key issues. But maybe that's all they have to do. Maybe all Labour has to do is keep quiet and carry on and wait for the Conservatives to sink. I think that would be an effective victory strategy, but not maybe a great one for government. There are not enough people of the requisite mindset to do anything, unfortunately, says Lord Melbury. I don't think he's a Lord in the same way that you are, by the way.
I haven't come up in the House of Lords now.
No, I think he's a character from a sitcom, as far as I remember. Lord Melbury adds, it doesn't matter how the public votes, the selected puppet will be installed. When will people learn it's all theatre to make them believe they have a say and that we live in a functioning democracy that values free speech and human rights? I don't think we do really particularly, but there we go. Stay with us. Do keep your calls and comments coming. I'm with Lord Moylan for a while longer. In about 25 minutes, we'll have Britain's favourite Reverend, Clyde Dewar, with his take on events of the last few days. I had him on earlier last week on today's news talk. He's always great value. But for now, we are with Lord Moylan. I'm Len Bitopic. This is the Len Bitopic Show right here on today's news talk, TNT. See you after
the break. My name's Stacey. I'm 57 and I was adopted in 2020.
We were adopted in 2019.
And we were adopted in 2021.
We had a house, and it sounds crazy, but it wasn't a home. The one thing that Jake and Emma brought is it became a home.
When I met Dakota, he had just turned 14.
You weren't there for the first this and the first that. I missed the first words, but we got a lot of other firsts.
Watching her say, oh my God, I cannot believe I got my license. And she's like, I passed. And I'm like, girl.
See them grow. It is.
They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
You and you.
Kids in the middle.
What I thought was a complete life was nowhere near complete. But it is now.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets with nowhere to go, but I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
1 in 10 young adults will experience a form of homelessness this year. For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there, providing hot meals, a safe place to sleep, medical care, and love.
They just really genuinely just wanted to help me succeed, and I'm succeeding.
To learn more, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
You're with Len Bitopic on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Len Bitopic Show. I'm still with Lord Moylan, Conservative peer. That means he is in the upper house, as we call it, in the United Kingdom, the House of Lords. We're going to talk a little bit about some legislation in a moment and about the built environment in the UK. And if I have time, about transport too. I think you're going to get some really interesting insights here. First, a few comments. These all from the TNT Radio.live chat. Shorty222 says, I always liked the idea of the monster raving loony party, Lord Such, but sadly never had a member in our area. Although he's a communist, Galloway seems a bit of a firework, and that's got to be a good thing. Old school is quite attractive now. Mazzy agrees with my comments about climate. Lord Melbury confirms that Lord Melbury is indeed a Fawlty Towers character. Fawlty Towers was a 12-part comedy, short-lived, but very, very iconic in British humour. Hemingway says, bad news for Labour is the serial election loser, Neil Kinnock, who was former leader of the Labour Party, has said that Labour cannot lose the next election. Reminiscing about 1992, Kinnock said, the press claimed it was an unlosable election, but I proved them wrong. So I suppose every election is losable, Lord Moylan. I managed to lose my seat after having had a record majority the previous time. So I say it with some humility. And it did seem that Neil Kinnock did grab defeat from the jaws of victory in 1992. So it's not an absolutely definite foregone conclusion, is it? But it might not be healthy for the Conservatives to win because they're not in the winning mindset anymore.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I think speculating about a Conservative victory at the next general election takes us slightly away from reality at the moment. Of course, things can happen. Anything can happen. An asteroid could land. I mean, you know, you never know. I think, you know, just simply on the evidence and on the numbers we've got and the consistent polling over the last 18 months, under Rishi Sunak, there is no real prospect of the Conservatives winning the election. It's still the case that Labour could, Keir Starmer could make some serious errors. And if you talk to the Labour Party, they'd say officially that, of course, nothing's in the bag, we're not complacent, and that they're still worried about the prospect that, you know, they might be the largest party, but not the majority. And then that is for them a realistic prospect that they want to ward off, and that's what they'd say. How many of them believe that? How many of them are secretly complacent? I don't know, but officially they are not complacent. So yes, you're right. It might not be an overwhelming Labour victory, and the people who'd say that would be the Labour Party.
Yes, there is a danger of complacency. Complacency played a small part in my own defeat in 2010, actually, but there are other factors too.
Played a large part of Neil Kinnock's defeat in 1992, of course.
Because people assumed he was going to win and they didn't feel so strongly about voting.
Because he went round to a pre-election rally basically saying we won, which went down very well with the members in the
Sheffield rally.
Apparently really upset the voters.
it was a catastrophic and cringe-making example of hubris, as I recall. Yes. I quite like Neil Kinnock as a person, and I think he'd freely admit he made a terrible error there.
Yes, yes.
But it reminds me of a story from the previous election, the 87 election, when a chap called Brian Gould from New Zealand was in charge of the Labour campaign. And
yeah, great man.
He's a very clever man, but Roy Hattersley hated him. And when Brian Gould left in disgust to return to his native New Zealand, Roy Hattersley managed to insult the man and the nation with a very amusing, if somewhat racist, comment. When Brian Gould returned to New Zealand from the United Kingdom, the average IQ went up in both countries, which isn't true, but it's a good line.
It isn't true. And he's a great supporter of Brexit, Brian Gould.
Was he? I didn't know that.
He's an anti-European. He was always an anti-European.
And actually, it wasn't really his fault anyway. He did his best in difficult circumstances, I think. Turning to your specialism, it's just great that you're here because I'm interested to know your views on the built environment. I know you have the Renters Reform Act on the desk there, and I have a personal interest in that. I'll drop you a note about it. It's a very straightforward and helpful thing. It's nothing even controversial that I'm asking about. But with the built environment, one of my concerns is that politicians are trying to socially engineer how we live, for example, by banning the creation of car parking spaces. My view, the mistaken belief that we can all live in 15-minute cities where everything's within 15 minutes of where you live. Well, frankly, the people who come up with that have no idea how most of the population actually live. To what extent is engineering how we're supposed to live perverting the way that we're designing our built environment?
Yeah, I think you have a very good point there. I mean, there are all sorts of nutty utopians. Like this whole idea of a 15-minute city was invented by somebody from some academic from Latin America sometime in the last 5 years. And everyone seems to have bought into it because they fall for slogans without thinking about what they actually mean. Of course, the great thing about living in a city like London, which is not a 15-minute city, but has a great transport system, getting around it, and that's crucial, is that we have access to some of the greatest galleries and museums in the world. We have some of the finest orchestras. We have some of the best pop concerts. We have a tremendous number of things we can do. If you live in a 15-minute city, let's call it a village. If you live in a village with no transport, you never get to see any of those things. Mm-hmm. Because you just can't, they just can't be supported. And you don't have to go back that far in history. I mean, only 100 years ago, 150 years ago, to find there were lots of villages in England that didn't actually have access to the direct access to the railway. And they were cut off. I mean, railway, before the motor car, railway was the way to get around. That's why the rail network went everywhere, but it didn't go quite everywhere. And if you were in some village that you didn't have a railway station, you really were living in circumstances that were quite medieval. You hardly ever left your village. And that would be lovely if you were a Green. I think all the Greens should go and live in places like that. Absolutely lovely. But what was your chance of getting a good job, getting a promotion? Being in a place like London with the great transport system, and I will bring transport in here, with the great transport mm-hmm. system we've got, means not only do you have access to sort of lots of interesting jobs that you might want to do, but also if you get a promotion, if you get the chance of a new job somewhere else, the chance of changing jobs so that you can improve your career, then you can still get to it. And this doesn't happen in villages. You know, if you're the receptionist in the doctor's surgery, what do you do next? If you're living in a 15-minute village with no transport.
And no buttered croissants, no meat either. Obviously,
no butter or meat allowed in. Obviously,
They do have everything searched, presumably, before you go in.
There'd be a lot of black market trade in, you know, the odd sausage. They'd all have secret gatherings when a sausage got in, wouldn't they? So they'd all, they'd have heard there's a sausage down at number 33, and they'd go around just for the smell of it cooking. They'd all be standing outside smelling sausage.
Woe betide the owner of bacon and an extractor fan in that case. I think it was Madrid earlier on. I didn't read it out, but it seems relevant now. He said that he had made Marmite flavored duck fat roast potatoes, which would be presumably a capital offense in a 15-minute city.
Yes, exactly.
And this is the preposterous thing about it. Although we're laughing, I first heard about this kind of thing in 1992. It was called Local Agenda 21. And when I was in local politics in Newcastle upon Tyne in north of England, and I thought it was a joke. I actually thought it was just a joke. I didn't think it was serious. And now the United Nations, in its infinite stupidity, is trying to push all these local agendas upon us as if this is the great thing to do. The greatest irony, of course, is the people who promote all of this spend fortunes flying around the world telling us not to fly and not to travel more than 15 minutes. As I noted yesterday on my show, Lord Moreland, one of the Green Party candidates, not far from where I'm sitting now, for a living, is an aircraft pilot. He's a Green Party candidate, and he's a commercial aircraft pilot. And he touts it. Yeah, it's incredible. He's still got 25%. So I suspect
I hope he's one of the first pilots to fly a battery-powered jumbo jet.
In order to have the same performance and range as an existing Boeing 737, which is roughly a 200-seater aircraft, the battery would have to weigh 1,200 tons, apparently, which causes some difficulties, I think. And in order to have a typical shipping container liner, shipping a ship, you need to charge the battery for 2 years, apparently, in order to get the same range. A question for you. Shorty too asks, I do like Lord Moylan, but he must know what an idiot Boris is with his views on depopulation and everything. What is your view of Boris? He was very successful in the election, but arguably...
I didn't know he had views on depopulation. I haven't heard those views. Boris, first of all, Boris is a very intelligent man. And part of his shambolic appearance is artifice, as you can imagine, and it covers a multitude of sins, if you like. And people like him and they like that shambolic sort of appearance. The civil servants and the ruling classes don't like it because they want an efficient CEO running the country. That's their vision of what a prime minister should be. But Boris will never fit that mold at all. He's got, like everybody else, he's got weaknesses as well as strengths. But the weaknesses are not the ones that are thrown at him. I mean, people say, he must be stupid. He's not stupid. He's extremely intelligent. He doesn't do detail. Yeah, he does do detail. He does do detail in subjects that he thinks are important that interest him. And sometimes, he's got a journal. You've got to remember, his background is as a professional journalist. And with a lot of subjects, he's got a journalist's eye. He sort of sees the story and the interest in something, and then he will go after it in detail. And he does do detail on stuff, and really very good on stuff that he's interested in and that's important to him and important to the job that he's doing. The other funny thing about Boris is that he hates parties. I mean, all this stuff about Partygate, he's not a party person. He clams up a bit. He's a bit shy in a way. He clams up a bit in parties. Of course, he does the sort of the back slapping and so on. He knows that as the head of Downing Street or whatever, it's his job to cheer up the troops. It's his job to turn up at leaving parties and when people are going or when they've achieved something or whatever. He knows that. But it's more a case of knowing it rather than being instinctively somebody who wants to rush out and, throw his arms around you and tell you how wonderful you are. There's a degree of sort of shyness and reticence in a way that he has to overcome in order to do that. So the idea that he's a party animal is the most ridiculous nonsense, or that, just by having a glass in his hand, I've never seen him drink very much. I can't claim a huge amount of social experience. I worked with him rather than spending my life living with him. Mm. I worked with him, but he wasn't one of these people who drank very much at all. So the whole idea that he's off there toping and having parties the whole time, most of which he wasn't even remotely at, was a complete travesty, really.
A couple of quick questions for you. Red asks, what is the noble lord's view on what Red calls the COVID scam? In other words, COVID. There's a lot of skepticism in my viewership about COVID and feels that it'd be mishandled. What's your view?
Yeah, well, I think, we decided to switch off the economy for a year, basically, or large parts of the economy for a year. And we're still suffering massively from that. And we will be for years to come. And, at the time, we weren't quite clear why we were doing it. It seemed to be, the message seemed to be save the NHS and don't have the sort of scenes that we saw on television. This is the worst thing that happened, is that in Italy, we saw scenes of overcrowded hospitals and people not being admitted to hospitals on our television before COVID actually hit us, because it hit Italy first, before us, at least. And we saw all of that. And I think that had a devastating effect, actually, on what people thought was going to happen here. And I think if this something like that were to happen again, we simply can't allow that sort of the same response. We've got to be much more targeted in trying to protect people who are in need of protection, the elderly. And in the case of COVID, of course, children were practically immune, as far as I can make out. So the elderly and people who are immune suppressed have got conditions where they're receiving medicines that make them immune suppressed and so on.
And last question, do you have a preference for who would take over from Rishi Sunak if he stood down? Suella Braverman, for example?
At the moment, I've got a sort of open mind. I think Suella Braverman would be very good, but there are others as well. No.
Thank you so much. I'll drop you a line about the other matter. Really appreciate That's your great. Time this morning, Lord Moylan.
I could go on for another hour.
We'll have you on for another hour, I promise you.
Thank you very much for having me, okay?
A real pleasure. Thanks very much indeed. Have a great rest of the day. And with that, we say goodbye to Lord Moylan. And briefly, we'll have a break. And then after that, we'll have Britain's favourite reverend, Kai Dewar, who'll be reviewing the affairs of the day in his own inimitable style. All of that with me on the Lembotopic Show right here on today's News Talk TNT. See you in a few moments.